Arizona's Medicaid expansion plan has been in the legal spotlight for a few years, but today the arguments went before a judge. But even with a ruling, this won't be the last step.
I enjoyed it, but the fact of the matter is I appreciate the fact that my decision probably has as much meaning as the outcome of a spring training game.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, more kids are entering state care because of abuse and neglect. Why the Chinese economy matters to Arizona mines.
How batteries could help solve the problem of energy shortages.
And getting medicine to those who need it most.
Our role is to take donated medicines inbound and get it where it needs to go, to free clinics, community health centers, and hospitals who will agree to provide the meds for free to the low-income uninsured.
Plus, a new study abroad destination and, hey, could I borrow a cup of flour?
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. And good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Early part of your afternoon commute, and that means if you got to work really, really early this morning, just one accident to tell you about. There's a collision on the 60 westbound at the Val Vista Drive off-ramp. Valley weather for the rest of today. It'll be partly cloudy, and we expect to reach a high of 105. For tonight, a 30% chance for rain. A dust storm is possible with lows in the mid-80s. Currently partly cloudy and 103.
A federal judge is refusing to block the planned South Mountain Freeway project in the valley. The preliminary injunction was requested by a coalition of environmental and community groups that filed suit against the project in June. U.S. District Judge Diane Humitiwa said the coalition didn't show the freeway would cause imminent and irreparable environmental harm in order to approve the request. Howard Shanker, the attorney representing the coalition, says he's disappointed the request was denied, but adds he's confident his clients will emerge successful.
But she has agreed to expedite consideration on the merits so that the plan, at least my understanding, is that she anticipates deciding this case before construction can begin.
That's expected in early 2016. The freeway would extend the Loop 202 by 22 miles to connect I-10 in Chandler and Levine.
Before students can attend their first day of kindergarten, parents are required to make sure their kids are up to date on their vaccines. After the recent measles outbreak in Arizona, Dr. Rebecca Sonnenschein with the Maricopa County Health Department says it's important for all students to be vaccinated before their first day of kindergarten, but she says that has not been the case.
The last year of data that we had, we saw about 93.7% of kindergartners were up to date on their vaccines, and that has been slowly trending down. So that indicates that more and more parents are choosing not to vaccinate their children.
5% of Maricopa County's incoming kindergartners were not vaccinated in 2013-2014.
Lawyers for the state and critics of Arizona's Medicaid expansion plan were in court this morning, trying to make their cases as to whether or not the expansion should remain or should go away. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Service was also in the courtroom and joins me. Hi, Howie.
Glad to be here. It's much more fun than the courtroom.
So what were the main arguments? We've heard so much about, is it a tax, is it not a tax? Was that basically what today came down to?
It's really what the issue is. I mean, you have a 1992 voter-approved constitutional amendment, and it says that if there is a tax or anything that results in a net increase in state revenues, it can only be approved by two-thirds of the House and the Senate. In other words, a simple majority doesn't do it. Well, the fact is that when Jan Brewer was pushing this thing back in 2013 and she couldn't get the two-thirds for a tax, she decided to craft it differently. In other words, she said, let's give the authority to Tom Betlock, who heads the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System,
the Medicaid,
Medicaid program, and we'll let him decide how much he needs to raise and let him decide which hospitals will pay it and how much each will pay, which is what they did. Based on that, that governor, and to a certain extent now the Ducey administration, is arguing this is simply a fee on hospitals, and because the legislature isn't enacting it, even though they authorized Betlock to do it, the two-thirds requirement doesn't apply. Obviously, Christina Sandifer from the Goldwater Institute, who's representing the lawmakers who didn't vote for it and are suing, is saying, look, you're going to blow a hell of a loophole in the whole idea of this two-thirds majority. I mean, all that would mean is that lawmakers would have to say, well, we're not levying a tax. We're just directing this agency to levy a fee on these people and this agency to levy a fee on these people. And all of a sudden, your two-thirds protection disappears.
And one of the key elements of this is that the expansion couldn't have passed with a two-thirds majority. There wasn't enough votes for it. So if it is, in fact, a tax that requires a two-thirds vote, Medicaid expansion basically goes away in Arizona, right?
Well, you've got three choices. Number one, as you point out, is you go back and you try to get the two-thirds vote and convince people that, look, you know, you've got 370,000 people who are now getting care, and it makes sense and it's what the voters wanted. Number two is the Ducey administration has to come up with the money, and it's probably in the neighborhood of $270 or $300 million a year. The third alternative is literally the Ducey administration telling 370,000 people, sorry, you're no longer getting care. And that is nothing that any governor wants to do. And what's fascinating is, if you remember, Governor Ducey opposed the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, which is what funds this, or funds the federal part of this, and now is in the position of having to defend it because the state budget is dependent on it. I don't think he wants to be the one to kick 370,000 people off of health care.
So this was the first hearing and first oral arguments over the actual facts of the case, whether or not this is a tax or not. But this is not the end of the road, right? Whatever the judge decides, this is not it.
Oh, I think it's very clear. And in fact, it was obvious to Judge Gerlach. And at the end of the hearing, in fact, here's exactly what he said.
I enjoyed it, but the fact of the matter is I appreciate the fact that my decision probably has as much meaning as the outcome of a spring training game.
And that's exactly it. He knows that whoever loses will go to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals will reach a decision and ultimately will go to the state Supreme Court, just as the first round did when then-Governor Brewer was arguing that the legislators didn't even have a right to sue. A decision the state Supreme Court said, no, I don't think so, Governor. I think you're wrong.
So did the judge give any kind of sense as to when he might rule to at least start the process of appeals?
He asked the attorneys, how intense a ruling do you want? Because we know you're taking it up. And they said, look, we need something to show your reasoning behind whether you determine it's a tax, a fee, an assessment, a voluntary contribution. He thinks that if it keeps it simple, he could probably get something out as early as next week.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
You're very welcome.
At this hour, Department of Child Safety Director Greg McKay is releasing a strategic plan that identifies goals and objectives for the agency. The Arizona Auditor General yesterday released a new report highlighting the increasing number of abused and neglected children entering state care. Since McKay was appointed DCS director in February, caseloads have continued to rise along with staff turnover. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports many in the child welfare community suggest it's the result of a culture shift.
Critics say that shift is trending more towards law enforcement, and some people say that's an indication of a misguided approach to child services.
There's much stronger flavor now on punitive methods and making parents pay for what they did and holding parents liable in a lot of ways.
Suzanne Shunk is the former president of the Arizona chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. She says social workers are uniquely qualified to work in child welfare.
Because the social work education actually provides specific skills that actually applies to child welfare in a way that other human service disciplines, and even more so law enforcement, don't have that kind of training and skills.
KJZZ has spoken with multiple former DCS managers who've elected to remain anonymous because of fear of retaliation. They claim Director Greg McKay leads through fear, and that's translated into how caseworkers interact with families. They say there's a rising pressure to remove children as opposed to less drastic measures. Since the same reporting period last year, the number of children removed from homes has increased 12%. Shunk recognizes the need to remove children in certain circumstances.
The power will be there regardless, but it doesn't have to be the emphasis and the main thrust or a threat that's talked about. And I think that's the difference that we hear frequently.
DCS spokesman Doug Nick says the department is aware of its purpose as a child welfare agency and points out Director McKay has taken steps to prevent a law enforcement culture. Shortly after his appointment, he dissolved the Office of Special Investigations, which was filled with many former police officers.
He dismantled that almost immediately because he realized, A, they don't have a legal purpose here in this agency, and B, the money and the resources that that office consumed could be far better used looking at allegations of child abuse and neglect.
That was the arm of the agency that conducted internal investigations. In fact, McKay was at the center of one of those investigations, but he was found not to have committed any wrongdoing. Nick says the agency has an Office of Quality Improvement, which meets the legal requirement of an inspections bureau. He also explains the director is looking to give caseworkers some of the same training as police officers.
So it gives the background and some of the information that would be helpful for some of our casework investigators to have a robust understanding of what law enforcement does without becoming law enforcement themselves.
Democratic State Senator Debbie McCune Davis sits on a Child Safety Oversight Committee, which requested monthly data from DCS. She says it's how the legislators can follow progress.
The agency had reported data on a monthly basis in the past, but now it's sort of, you know, coming out a little bit at a time. It's really not what we need to know the condition of the agency.
Workers report ongoing caseloads that are nearly double state standards. According to the Department of Administration, 280 employees left DCS between February and June. As of last month, the agency had 477 vacant positions. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Supreme Court's decision legalizing same-sex marriage didn't eliminate other kinds of discrimination for members of the LGBT community. A handful of cities in Arizona, Phoenix, Tempe, Flagstaff, and Tucson, have extended anti-discrimination ordinances to their local businesses. And in Glendale, a proposal by Councilman Gary Sherwood would do the same thing, potentially. Tonight at 6, the city holds its final public meeting on that proposed ordinance. Kim Larson is a public information officer for Glendale. Kim, a few meetings have already been held, and what's the general sentiment been?
We've talked to a lot of people, you know, residents from, you know, diverse groups. We don't really have anything to report as of yet on the sentiment, but a lot of people providing input, which is really the goal.
And has there been a variety of input?
Yeah, definitely. Different viewpoints, and it's been a really good discussion. It's been a good format for these discussions. We have a facilitator that, you know, kind of walks through, you know, the process and how we, you know, how we're going to discuss it. And I think it's been a very beneficial outreach for us.
Can you give us an idea of whether feedback at meetings like this ends up sort of potentially changing what the council ends up doing? Or in some ways, it's just sort of due diligence. These are residents, they deserve to be heard, and then we move on.
This process is definitely very important. The city council directed staff to talk to residents and also business owners. We held a special meeting for businesses. So that definitely all of the information will be gathered and compiled, and that information will be presented to the city council so that they can, you know, review all of that. And I definitely, you know, that will be under consideration as they look at this issue moving forward.
Kim, has there been language that has been proposed, whether it changes or not? Has there been sort of a standard template set out of these are the things where if the ordinance was in effect, these are certain things that would be part of the ordinance?
No, we're not to that stage at this point. It's just a lot of information gathering right now.
Has Glendale paid attention to what other cities in the Valley, other cities in the country are doing as far as why the city decided to take even the step of looking into this?
Yes, definitely. That was part of the consideration. We did look at other, specifically Valley cities, to see, you know, what other cities are doing and what's kind of the standard thus far, if there is one, for, you know, the process, especially the process just at this point on getting to the point of making that decision about an ordinance.
So the final meeting on this issue is tonight at 6. Once information is gathered, since this is the final public meeting that concerns the issue, can you give us any sort of timeline? Has that been discussed yet as to when the council would vote on it, when, if it's implemented, it would be implemented?
No, I don't have any timeline to give you at this point. From this point, it does take some time to put together all of the information. We'll definitely have information for the public forthcoming when we are ready to, you know, move on to the next stage.
Kim Larson is Public Information Officer for the City of Glendale. Kim, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Still to come, a change in American foreign policy could mean new, unique opportunities for ASU students.
We're already telling prospective students they have to be extremely flexible with the conditions of Cuba and not to compare it to what they think of maybe as a European experience.
That's ahead. It's the show. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. Valley weather for the rest of today. We're expecting partly cloudy skies and a high temperature of 105. And then for tonight, a 30% chance for rain. Of course, we had a 60% chance for rain last night. Didn't quite materialize through much of the valley. Tonight, we'll have lows in the mid-80s. For tomorrow, a 20% chance for rain with a high right around normal of 106. Currently, relative humidity is at 23%. It's partly cloudy and 103. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, there's one accident to watch out for. It's on the 60 westbound at Val Vista, and it's on the off-ramp. It's 219.
KJZZ is supported by Goodwill of Central Arizona, where your donations helped place more than 44,000 Arizonans in jobs last year. Learn more about how your Goodwill is working at goodwillaz.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. The American landscape has been the source of stories since the creation myths of the Iroquois Nation. The ground the Native Americans traversed served as the inspirations for the stories they told, and the stories were the maps of the places around them.
But in our time, we carry maps on our phones. They tell us where to go, but omit the stories that might slow us down as we rush around under strict orders from GPS commands.
This omission is the driver behind a project called Atlas Obscura, a map of journeys across America that commands us to slow down and take the trip of Robert Pirsig in the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, or Kerouac's book On the Road, or Tom Wolfe's book The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and many others. It's the ultimate literary website. And freelance writer Richard Kreitner is a contributor, along with mapmaker Stephen Melendez, who created the map. Richard, what do you see out there, out the window, when you travel across the country?
I see vast expanses that it's surprising to find are still one country, and refreshing to, you know, relearn that they are.
And books that go from one end of the country to the other, literary creations that are legendary, that have places associated with them that people need to see.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I've taken many road trips by myself with a bunch of these in my back pocket, and they're a great guide to the United States.
So what kinds of trips did you choose, thinking in terms of the vast expanse that was possible in North America?
Sure. Well, I wanted narratives that were kind of in the first person. So it's one person, either in fiction, like On the Road, or nonfiction, like Cheryl Strayed's Wild, where they're describing the landscape as it kind of unfolds before them. So the Lolita, for instance, didn't make the cut because the road trip sections are not in chronological order. They're all helter-skelter. You can't map that. So I just wanted a clean narrative across the landscape where you could see, most importantly to me at least, how the different authors intersected and how they described the same place at different times in different or similar ways.
And you can read your way across the country in these narratives. You can actually hop in the vehicle and or the motorcycle and go to those places and read as you go.
Exactly. Or across time as well. My favorite part is like when in Salt Lake City, you have an intersection of Mark Twain, Jack Kerouac, and Ted Conover, a journalist who rode the rails with hobos.
Sure.
And to see the different ways that they describe the mountains around Salt Lake City, to me, is like a whole history of American literature and indeed the country.
What do the intersections tell you?
They tell me that, well, it's in the details. It's in the way, the different ways that they describe it. So,
because the places don't change over that time, really.
Well, they do. I mean, Salt Lake City did change from the 1860s to the 1980s, and the ways in which American writers describe those changes is telling. I mean, Twain uses this illustrious, grand language to describe the mountains and the heavens, and Kerouac is describing that's Dean Moriarty's birthplace, Salt Lake City. So he's describing Dean Moriarty emerging bedraggled many years ago. It's like a whole mid-century American thing. And then Ted Conover is describing this post-industrial landscape of factories and forgotten industry, and that says something about 1980s America.
And you know, in the shadow of the Mormon temples, actually.
Right.
The book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance is very much about landscape and place, and not human settlements, but physical landscape and an interior story that's going on at the same time. How did you decide to choose that one?
Well, I read that one on the road many years ago as well, so it was a natural, and everyone loves that book. A lot of the books and a lot of the descriptions of landscape are sort of, I'm glad you said that, are kind of descriptions of internal landscapes and emotional states. And that's also very interesting when you trace the lines across the map.
I mean, part of what I think about when I look at this project is that people don't necessarily travel across the country in the way that they used to in the 20th century.
Absolutely. This is definitely a piece of propaganda to get people to travel across the country. In the intro for the map on the website House Obscura, I quote this 1865 travel book, which I think is maybe one of the first American cross-country travel books. And it's by a guy named Samuel Bowles, an old Massachusetts newspaper editor. And he says something like, "There is no such knowledge of the nation as comes from traveling its vast extent and meeting its purposeful people." And I think that that's true. And I think that many of our kind of social and political difficulties and the great assortment of people into red states and blue states, or red areas and blue areas of the states, has a lot to do with the fact that we see Thailand before we see Tennessee.
Hmm. When did you take your first trip across the country, and how meaningful was it for you?
It was very meaningful. 10 years ago, a road trip with my dad to California. He did a lot of train travel in the 70s by himself. And then 4 years after that, I did my own first solo jaunt. And I've done that around 8 times.
Car, motorcycle?
No, I wish motorcycle.
Rails?
Mostly rails. Twice by car with my girlfriend. We did a 4-month road trip.
And you were still speaking by the end?
Yeah, still speaking today.
Still speaking today? Excellent. Richard Kreitner, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Richard Kreitner is an archivist for The Nation magazine and a freelance writer. He helped create a map of literary journeys across America for Atlas Obscura.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
The thawing relations between the U.S. and Cuba has American businesses thinking about the potential of that new market. We wanted to find out how Arizona companies may fare in that competition, so we called Arnold Maltz. He's an associate professor in supply chain management at the ASU W.P. Carey School of Business.
First of all, the question is what they are allowed to do under the exceptions right now. I don't have any idea whether Congress is going to lift the real embargo or not, given the political situation, but when I looked at the exceptions identified by the lawyers, there are some that kind of jump out. I mean, personal computers, mobile telephones, things like that. We do some of that in this area, but more to the point, people like Avnet, which is one of the biggest resellers around, can probably deal in that area. Then you're talking about some of the other guys like Honeywell and so forth, who have mostly, as I understand it, had gone government to government. I don't believe, from what I can tell, that the aerospace stuff is really on the table yet. Now, in terms of services, I would guess that, for example, an American Express could now set up a correspondent banking business with Cuban banks, and certainly the credit card kind of situation that they deal with, and some of the business-to-business financing might work out very nicely for them. Some of our smaller specialized software companies could look into this if they have time.
Given the economic situation in Cuba, how much business do you think companies here could reasonably expect to do?
You know, in a country like that, the key is knowing who is likely to bring stuff in, who's got the money. Historically, I guess it's been the government, but I suspect with more and more people coming in, going from the U.S. to there, and perhaps sparking some import kinds of businesses, there might be a possibility to do a reasonable amount, again, of very specialized stuff. And I think the question is whether somebody here who's small wants to try and specialize in that and somehow make up a specific book of business that they think would work in Cuba.
Does geography play any role here? I mean, would Arizona be at a disadvantage, or companies in Arizona be at any kind of disadvantage than firms in places like Florida or somewhere else in the Southeast?
Yeah, I think that's very likely. That's why you really need to be specialized. The natural thing for the Cubans is going to be to go to Florida. Maybe some to Texas and the Gulf, but certainly Florida is going to be the natural place to go.
How big of a difference would it make if Congress went ahead and just lifted the embargo? I mean, would that be a significant change for that?
I think it would be very helpful, because then all of a sudden you're looking at things like airlines in Cuba that would need to be updated. It's similar in some ways to Iran opening up, in the sense that there's a lot of stuff we've just said, we're not going to sell you guys. And as a result, some of their infrastructure, some of their things like utilities and airlines and transportation systems, which back in the 50s, which is a long time ago now, were basically American, and then which were upgraded in some ways by the Russians, I imagine, probably need major upgrades, assuming the Cubans could find the money to do it.
That would presumably, though, also increase competition, right? It wouldn't just be Arizona firms if the embargo was lifted that could benefit.
Well, I think the real problem is the Europeans are already there, and the Mexicans, I'm sure. Most of the Latin Americans are already trading with Cuba. So we're already behind the eight ball on that.
Arnold Maltz is an associate professor in supply chain management at the ASU Carey School of Business. The renewed ties between the U.S. and Cuba are impacting another area at ASU. The school is proposing two study abroad programs to the island, one for spring break 2016 and one for next summer. Adam Henry directs ASU's study abroad office. And Adam, for how long have these plans actually been in the works?
So once we got word that Cuba was reopening up for educational purposes, we had ASU faculty contacting us, asking us different possibilities of going there. And so we're working with a few partners on the ground to make this happen. And I would say probably within the last 4 to 5 months, they were established, and they're still in the proposal process, but they're looking like they're going to run for spring and summer.
What kinds of things would students be learning about and studying there?
Yeah, so for the spring break program, they're going to be taking a course at ASU for about 7.5 weeks. And this class, the program in Cuba, is at the end of the class. So the on-ground part of the course will give students the opportunity to immerse themselves in the Cuban context. There's a portion in the course that's considered to be focused on the political, cultural, environmental, and economic segments of Cuban society. And there's meetings arranged with Cuban citizens who are farmers, business leaders, civic leaders, historians, faculty, and then also Cuban students. And then in the summer, there's a great opportunity for students who are studying kind of healthcare and different fields within the health kind of arena to be able to learn more about the healthcare system in Cuba and to be able to compare it to the changing healthcare system in the U.S., which will allow students to understand the challenges in delivering effective healthcare to different populations. And then there's actually an opportunity on that program for students to live with Cuban families.
What kinds of challenges do you think that a program like this will face in a place that a lot of Americans don't know much about as far as what is actually going on the ground, because Americans haven't really been there much over the last, you know, several decades? So what kind of challenges does a program like this have to sort of overcome to make it work?
Yeah, I mean, when we're working with students, we're also working with parents and families. And so I think some of potentially the obstacles will be families maybe just not knowing if it's the best place for their students or the safest place. So all of the ASU study abroad programs go through a very thorough and effective health and safety and security review. So I think we, from a health and safety standpoint, we have that covered. I also, because it's new and because this will be the first time in a long time that we're sending students, we will be relying a lot on our partners on the ground and not having as much control as our other programs. So that might create some obstacles. We're already telling prospective students they have to be extremely flexible with the conditions of Cuba and not to compare it to what they think of maybe as a European experience.
How confident are you that when the students are actually in Cuba, it will be an open and sort of free learning environment? Because Cuba is not necessarily known for that sort of thing.
Yeah, these programs are pretty self-contained, and so we're not worried about kind of what is being shared or what is being taught. There's not going to be Cuban students in the classroom, so I think that the limitations are removed in that way. So fairly confident that at least what ASU faculty are providing to students, that it will be sound and accurate. And then as we bring in guest lectures, you know, that might be another story, but we're pretty confident that our providers and partners on the ground are selecting the right guest lectures for our students.
Do you have a sense yet of how much interest there is among ASU students to be going to Cuba?
The application process for both of these programs have not yet opened, but as we survey students and just connect in with students who contact us, there seems to be a lot of interest. But at the end of the day, we felt like starting smaller and then growing would be the smartest thing. So that's why we're focusing on two programs for now.
Adam Henry, director of the ASU Study Abroad Office. Adam, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Benjamin Butler. I am the miller for Hayden Flour Mills. I work with an Osteroller flour mill. That was all hand-built, custom-made. As we continue to bring back more varieties of grain, I love to experiment with the grains. One of our newer grains that we grew was a Tibetan purple barley. And so I thought, what if we turned this into a pasta? How would you like a purple pasta? When you know that there has been so much dedicated craftsmanship put into it, and it gets passed on to you to be the miller for specialty grains, it's more than just grains going in and flour coming out. But quality flour with a quality built machine.
You just heard Benjamin Butler milling flour at Hayden Flour Mill in Queen Creek. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we need more time to rise, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Coming up, this is how our current consumer energy system works.
Everything is built around basically the worst case scenario. You have to make sure, as an operator, that there's sufficient capacity in the grid for the very hottest day in August.
We'll look at how advances in energy storage could change that. It's the show.
Good afternoon. In Valley traffic this afternoon, not much going on. There is an accident, though, I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue. It's on the off-ramp, so be careful in that area. Valley weather for the rest of today, we will stay partly cloudy and look for a high of 105. Then for tonight, a 30% chance for rain, a dust storm possible as well. Lows will be in the mid-80s, and then tomorrow, cloudy with a 20% chance for rain and a high of 106. It's currently 103 degrees at 236.
KJZZ is supported by the Piper Center for Creative Writing at ASU, now accepting applications for Your Novel Year, an intensive online program with small classes and personal attention. Early deadline is August 31st. Piper.asu.edu.
The reported slowdown in China's economy means market watchers are paying close attention to copper demand and prices. Both are of importance to Arizona. To get a sense of that relationship, we turn to Michael Block, chief strategist at Rhino Trading Partners in New York.
In recent history, China was a very large consumer of copper and was really the fulcrum, if you will, for how supply and demand worked in the world. Where they had a demand because they were doing building and building a lot of infrastructure all at once. And that was really the game 8 to 10 years ago. And the perception has remained commodities, China. That's been the association. I could make the argument that recently that hasn't been the case as much, but China's still a very important end user. Chinese growth is slowing. Because of that, you were in a situation where China's slowing growth means that there's going to be this perception or there's going to be less demand for copper. And therefore, that's going to create a problem and less people are going to be trying to speculate positively in copper. And that's going to create this supply-demand imbalance. I would argue that really, even if China was growing more than it is right now, a lot of the game of building infrastructure and building and construction in China has played out. And to me, that's a bit of an issue here.
Has the price of copper been affected at all by the challenges, I assume, that folks like you face in trying to figure out what an economy like China's is going to do when it's not the same kind of economy as the one we have, for example, here?
That's just it. Do we trust the numbers and the numbers real? What's driving that economy? The thought is it's things like construction, things like business investment, capital investment, investment in inventories is still much more important to China than it is in the United States. So there is this perception that it is important. I would argue that if you want to look long-term at China, you have to realize China is going, as the middle class continues to evolve and emerge in a country like that, and in emerging markets in general, consumption is going to become much more important than investment.
Even though the growth in the Chinese economy has slowed down a little bit recently, it still makes a lot of things that it exports to the rest of the world, right? So wouldn't it still need at least a decent amount of copper to do that kind of manufacturing?
Yeah, it really depends upon, you know, what the exports are. So there is that demand, but on the margin, the demand is lower. Now, you know, we watch copper and we watch some of these stocks, and they had a nicer run in the beginning of the year, and some of that was based upon hopes that the Chinese government was going to undertake some sort of fiscal stimulus, and that the People's Bank of China, their version of the Federal Reserve, was going to do some monetary stimulus by cutting rates, cutting reserve requirements, easing money. And we watched some of these copper stocks run to levels where I remember shaking my head and saying, I want to meet the people who are buying these stocks. And then lo and behold, as prices have come off and growth has come off and some of the supply-demand dynamics have played out, these stocks have, in some cases, been cut in half.
How much of an impact do you think that China has on the price of copper relative to all the other factors that influence that?
They are not the major domo that they once were, but they're still quite important here. And I think, you know, that is key, and I will acknowledge that. I think it becomes less important over time. The point is, if it's not China, where is it going to be? Is it going to be Brazil? Is it going to be Vietnam? Is it going to be Russia? I can point to each of these countries and point out issues they're having as well. Or is it going to be the United States? Is the United States going to lead the way in copper demand?
Michael Block is chief strategist at Rhino Trading Partners in New York City. Michael, thank you so much.
Mark, thank you.
Energy use in the U.S. and around the world is expected to continue to grow along with the population, and that has led to more research and development related to energy storage, which in turn is advancing battery technology and technology for converting the power of batteries to the electrical grid. Daniel Cormode is director of labs at Bay 4 Technical Services in Tucson. Daniel, are we talking about batteries that have a shelf life, like the batteries we're used to using in our everyday lives?
Yes, batteries do have they have both a usage life and a calendar life. So the calendar life is pretty easy to understand. You put it on a shelf, and if you don't use it that much, it can last some number of years. This will depend strongly on the chemistry. For example, a lead-acid battery, like what's found in automobiles that's used to start your automobile, those will have a shelf life of 5 years or so. And then the kind of battery that's used in cell phones, if you didn't use it, those have a shelf life of more like 20 years. And then they have a life based on the amount that you use it, the number of times that you charge it all the way up and you discharge it. And for a cell phone battery, that may be 1,000 times. You may have noticed with your cell phone, if you discharge your cell phone all the way down to zero, and you do that every day, the battery will lose its capacity much, much more quickly than if it only discharged down to 50% and then you recharged it back up. So that strong, deep discharge, that wears the battery out faster.
How big an impact in general is the concept of energy storage, whether it's in batteries or in more advanced technology? How much do you expect that to affect sort of the broader market, whether it comes to the grid and how people use it, whether it comes to what people are paying to use the grid?
Eventually, it will have a big impact. The nature of the electrical grid is that once power is pushed into the grid, whether it's from a nuclear power plant or a coal-burning power plant or a PV plant, once the power is pushed into the grid, it has to be used immediately. This generates a scenario where you build your power plants and you build your transmission lines, and everything is built around basically the worst-case scenario. You have to make sure, as an operator, that there's sufficient capacity in the grid for the very hottest day in August. And this turns into, when you're billing consumers, this can turn into a fair amount of what they're paying for is the ability to get power on that hottest day. Battery storage or some kind of other energy storage could allow us to defer capacity improvements to the grid by putting in energy storage in a way that could put in energy storage for the very few times of the year when you need a lot of power. You can then avoid building additional infrastructure.
If all goes well, to what extent do you think this could not only create opportunities for consumers potentially, but also create a market where this could really become, if it isn't already, a really huge business and one that can be very lucrative in the broader sense?
Well, in certain places in the United States, there is already a market for the ability to add power to the grid very rapidly or remove power from the grid very rapidly. In Arizona, we have vertically integrated utilities. So APS and the Salt River Project and TEP, they take care of everything required to get electricity to the consumer. In some other markets, it's done in a different way where a number of players each participate, adding one piece of what's required to keep the grid in balance. So, for instance, in Pennsylvania, there is a market where the operators could notice that the grid is out of balance by, say, 5 megawatts. And they say, oh, we are short 5 megawatts right now. And they then would pay somebody to add that 5 megawatts in, maybe just for 5 minutes, maybe for 10 minutes. And that is a place where already energy storage is a economically viable a way to meet that need and that demand that has already been existing for some time.
Daniel Cormode is Director of Labs at Bay4 Technical Services in Tucson. We've been talking about the present and future of energy storage. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. The show's a KJZZ original production, blending news from our community with national and international stories.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Griebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
Members of the San Carlos Apache tribe returned to Arizona this week after traveling to Washington, D.C. to protest the proposed Resolution Copper Mine near Superior. The project got federal approval last December when it was added to the National Defense Authorization Act, although a bill sponsored by Democratic Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva aims to repeal that section of the measure. San Carlos Tribal Council member Wenzler Nosey was among those who made the trip.
I guess the first big thing is it was going across this country and educating everyone about what had taken place with the land exchange. So, you know, that's what took us to Washington, D.C., and being able to educate people in this country as well as people in Congress.
Is the hope that that education will lead to a different result?
Well, you know, it was amazing. You know, that was the focus when we left Arizona, but when we got there, it just seemed like the focus was greater than what we expected, only because crossing this country, we found that, you know, fracking and subsiding to land, you know, from either oil or water, I mean, it was really an eye-opener, as well as educating them about the environmental impact study and the administrative process that are required, and seeing that not only is it happening to reservations, but it's happening across this country when Congress is giving exemptions to the law. And it just seems like, you know, as we gathered information and people from different color of race, you know, were pouring into the topic, we realized that we all live in the same boat, that Congress is doing things without protecting the future.
So for you, did that sort of shift the conversation away from the Resolution Copper issue in Oak Flat to maybe what other tribes are dealing with or what other people dealing with similar situations elsewhere are dealing with?
Well, you know, it seemed that way, but then when you come right back down to it, it's all the same, you know, and so our voice became greater because now we are carrying an American voice, and that's why, you know, people cannot look at this as a Native American issue. It's an American issue. Leaving Washington, you know, the feeling with Grijalva and every other congressman that came out and spoke and everyone that we had talked to is that the possibility is there that the repeal can happen, but now it depends on the American people to stand up.
If, as you say, the fight now is all about the public sort of standing up and saying this is not right, this shouldn't happen, How do you keep the momentum for that now that the publicity and the attention and everything from your trip across the country to D.C. is over?
Well, it's not over. We're coming here to America because, I mean, we're coming here to Arizona. The next scheduled event would be in November, where all the tribes and Indian nations across this country that are affected by this bill, and all the church groups from North Carolina to all the ones we met in Chicago, Detroit, New York, and every congressional leader, we're bringing them here to Arizona. So I will be petitioning the National Congress of American Indians to hold a special meeting here in Arizona. And then all those doubters and all those people who fail to really understand, it's going to give them the opportunity to come here and witness for themselves firsthand the religious aspects and then the devastation of contamination that will occur from this. So we're going to shine the light on Arizona, and that's the great effort that we're going to make. Now that we've done it in Washington and they're aware of this issue, now is to bring back the light to Arizona.
Wenzler Nosey is a member of the San Carlos Apache Tribal Council and a former tribal chairman. As for the project itself, Resolution Copper expects the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, review to start by the end of the year, although it could be about a decade before ore starts coming out of the ground. Andrew Taplin is project director for the Resolution Copper Project.
The project enjoys a significant amount of support locally and regionally. What we've found is that each time there has been a concern associated with the project and we've had the opportunity to sit down and talk through those concerns, more often than not we've found a solution, and more often than not we've been able to make adjustments to our mine plan of operations or development plans to be able to cater for any of those concerns. We will continue to reach out to those groups, in particular San Carlos Apache leadership, that do have concerns about the project. And I'm very confident if we can sit down at the table and have some rich dialogue that we can talk through the concerns that they have and hopefully come up with a solution.
Can you give me a sense of some of the concerns that you've heard that have led to changes in what you guys might be doing?
So there was a concern expressed that access to the Oak Flat campground would be limited as a result of the piece of legislation. So lawmakers amended the language such that there was a provision for ongoing access to Oak Flat for recreational reasons and traditional reasons. Whilst ever it's safe to do so, there was a concern about the extent of consultation with affected Native American tribes. So as well as the regulatory requirement under NEPA to consult, the legislation also requires for a heightened level of consultation with affected Native American tribes. There was concern over Apache Leap. So there's been a special management area established on Apache Leap, and 806 acres will be put into permanent protection, and we'll forgo our mining rights in that particular area. And the fourth and probably most significant improvement that was made was the exchange of the land at Oak Flat will actually not take place until the final environmental impact statement is published. So, you know, there are four quite material changes that were reflected in that bill prior to final passage.
Do you imagine more potential changes down the road, or is where you are pretty much where you want to be?
The mine plan of operations reflects a plan to develop the mine. What's fabulous about the National Environmental Policy Act is it provides for significant public input and significant opportunity for us to be able to revise and adjust and improve that mine plan of operations. So we're very much looking forward to the journey that we're going on with significant public input so we can come up with a best mine plan possible.
I assume that only goes so far, though, because there are, as you know, many in the San Carlos Apache tribe that would just as well prefer that the mine not happen at all. I imagine, from your perspective, that is not on the table.
Well, the key for us is dialogue. And the result and the outcome may not necessarily need to be one or the other. You know, the result doesn't necessarily need to be a mine or not a mine. I'm very confident with some dialogue. We can talk through the concerns and fully expectant that we could potentially have both. That is, we can have a mine and have all the economic benefits that come with a mine, but we also are very respectful of the Native American communities that have traditionally used that land and have cultural preservation and religious preservation at the same time.
Andrew Taplin is project director for the Resolution Copper Project.
A correction and clarification to a story we did this week about Arizona's practice of drug testing the state's welfare recipients. We quoted a number of 87,000 drug tests administered. That was actually the number of people the state screened for testing through the first 3 years of the program. Since the story aired, the Arizona Department of Economic Security has sent us updated figures showing that more than 170,000 welfare recipients to date have been screened in the nearly 6 years since the program was implemented.
While a judge heard arguments today that could impact whether around 350,000 Arizonans get to keep their Medicaid coverage, a Nashville-based charity helps five Arizona clinics get medication to patients who can't afford it. Dispensary of Hope started as a plan by a physician to give expiring samples to people who could use them. The group now gets meds that have up to 6 months left before they expire and sends them to clinics around the country. Chris Palumbo is the charity's CEO.
That original idea has evolved into a national collaborative of health systems and drug manufacturers who utilize their overproduction and surplus to care for the needs of the low-income uninsured across the United States. But our role is to take donated medicines inbound and get it where it needs to go, to free clinics, community health centers, and hospitals who will agree to provide the meds for free to the low-income uninsured.
Are the medicines that you dispense donated from hospitals, from drug manufacturers, from doctor's offices, from some combination of those?
Yes, Mark, all the above. So you can imagine pharmaceuticals, super, super regulated materials. And without getting deep into the regulation, what I can share with you is we only accept medicine that has never left the healthcare supply chain. And you can imagine from manufacturers and from health systems, these are the very same medicines and exactly as usable as medicines that, for those of us who are blessed to be insured, that we would get at a pharmacy. It's exact same. So those are the medications we get, and what we've evolved to over time is to have much, much more medicine coming from drug manufacturers. I think today we're probably at 80% or so of our medicine that we distribute has come directly from manufacturers right off their assembly line, and that number in the next 5 years will actually go up to about 96 or 97% of the medicines we distribute will come directly from the drug manufacturers.
That kind of begs the question that if manufacturers are giving you all of this medication, wouldn't it make more sense for them to maybe sell it for less money and maybe more people would be able to afford it and they could perhaps make a little more money on it?
Yeah, you know, Mark, in the United States and across the world, the pharmaceutical supply chain is really an amazing structure. You know, it produces health among the among those who have chronic illness and acute illness, and it does so, you know, really for fairly inexpensive and efficient and convenient. And within the pharmaceutical supply chain, there's a tremendous amount of competition between branded manufacturers and generic manufacturers. We all understand the need for medicines and certainly have those stories where folks are unable to afford. And I can tell you the manufacturers that we work with are very conscious of the most efficient ways to produce, but that production still results in surplus. Now, it may not be a lot of surplus for any one manufacturer, but you multiply all the manufacturers together in an industry that sells about $300 billion in medicine, you really don't need a lot of surplus to be able to do an awful lot of good.
Do you find that the medications that are coming into the Dispensary of Hope match the needs of the patients who are going to the clinics with whom you work?
Indeed, yeah. So you can imagine that the most pervasive chronic illnesses result in the highest percentage of medicines being manufactured, and the highest percentage of manufactured medicines result in some level of surplus. So that which the dispensary has offered, I'm going to guess that there are 10,000 chemical names and strengths that are manufactured across the globe and are considered either over-the-counter, branded, or generic pharmaceuticals. We only accept a small portion of those, but the ones that we see and are offered very much line up with the big medical issues. And for those of you who are not healthcare professionals, what we experience is the big diseases are diabetes, asthma, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, high cholesterol, and anxiety and depression. So we see a lot of medicines for those items in surplus simply because there are a lot of medicines to treat those diseases.
Chris Palumbo is CEO of Dispensary of Hope. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Mark, and best to your listeners.
And make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show. We'll take a look at the relationship between Arizona and its cities and towns. Also, what can Arizona do to reduce the number of high schoolers who drop out? Those stories and much, much, much more tomorrow at 2.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah. Tomorrow at 2 on the show.
Mark, if we're looking for something to do tonight, you should probably get in bed pretty early after working the early shift.
I'd like to.
But we're already in Phoenix, Arizona. If we wanted to go all the way to Tacoma, to be Philadelphia and Atlanta, could we go see the Steve Miller Band tonight at 9 at Talking Stick Resort?
That is a good, good idea. You can also check out the hip-hop group Injury Reserve. They'll be performing tonight at the Crescent Ballroom.
And the Ghostlight Youth Theater, Alice in Wonderland, that's tonight at 7 in Sun City West.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is up next on member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix. And HD. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 3 o'clock.